According to the May 2024 Social Security Trustees Report, the Social Security Fund reserves will run out by 2035. This means that without some kind of changes, in 9 years, retirees would then only be able to receive 83% of their full benefits. Last year, the federal government spent $2.2 trillion on Medicare and Social Security, the two largest federal programs that are on an unsustainable course. Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, the host of The Commonwealth Matters, and thank you for joining us. Joining us to talk further about the need for fiscal responsibility in our federal government is Dr. Mark Warshawski, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Social Security and retirement issues, pensions, long-term care, disability insurance, and the federal budget. Before joining AIE, Dr. Warshawski served as an assistant secretary of economic policy at the Treasury Department from 2004 to 2006, and he held senior positions at the Federal Reserve Board, the IRS, and several other institutions. Mark, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters program.
It's my pleasure to be here, Richard.
Hey, I appreciate you taking time to share your expertise and wisdom when it comes to federal spending and, in particular, federal entitlement programs. And I want to start out with a recent article that you wrote in the Journal of Policy Modeling, where you and your co-authors found that the current fiscal trajectory of the United States is unsustainable, with future deficits and debt well beyond both historical norms and official projections. Now, we've known this for years. Those who pay attention to federal trends and maybe, we'll put it this way, irresponsible federal spending, yet the spending has continued. And I think back, for example, the Tea Party wave back in between 2008 and 2010, there was a focus on irresponsible spending. And what triggered that was the crash in the U.S. housing market, irresponsibility in the investment sector. So we've known this trend that the U.S. federal government's been on for years, and it seems that it takes a crisis to wake us up. It's not just an election. It's not just politicians saying we're going to reduce federal spending, because nothing really changes, does it? What do we need to change the course of this fiscal irresponsibility that our federal government's on?
Well, there are a couple of factors. It's certainly the case, and you know, I'll cite another piece of research that I've done, is that the majority of the problem here is on the spending side. It's not on the revenue side. So when you look at government revenues, you know, basically taxes from income taxes and from payroll taxes, other sources of federal revenues, it's been pretty steady. You know, it goes up a little bit and down a little bit with the economy, with the recessions or stock market crashes or booms. So you have some volatility there, but pretty much it's been steady. But what has been increasing, and what has always been out of line, but is increasingly so, is spending. Spending has been increasing as a share of the economy. And now we're pretty much what used to be, you know, we'd have a deficit of 2-3%, maybe going up a little bit with the recession, but now we're you know, steadily at 5-6% deficits, which are, as you indicated, are not sustainable in the long run. The other thing which has shielded the federal government somewhat from the impact of these deficits is that about 10 years ago, interest rates came down a lot. So the cost to the federal government of the deficits was lower because they didn't have to pay interest on the debt. But that has disappeared. You know, that disappeared with the big bout of inflation that had to tighten. And now we have interest rates, you know, 4-5% that the federal government has to pay. I would say that is one way in which the spending can be reined in, because as interest rates increase, the cost and the crowding out of the deficits to anything else that the government does, you know, gets worse and worse. And it's a vicious cycle, because, you know, as deficits increase, interest rates increase, and then that increases the deficit. And, you know, before you know it, you could in fact get into a crisis just on that basis alone. So I think, you know, that scenario, you know, could be the way that we get a grip on our deficit problem.
So last year, the federal deficit was $1.7 trillion, according to the source that I looked at earlier today. That means that the federal government spent $1.7 trillion more than what it took in last year. If you look at what the interest rate that we're paying on the federal debt, which $35 trillion roughly in that ballpark, just the interest that the federal government's going to start paying, well, this year, I believe it's $900 billion, somewhere in that range. Next year, and for the next 10 years, just the interest rate alone on our federal debt is projected to be about $1 trillion. Is that how you, what you understand, Mark?
Yeah, that's easily the case. It's probably even a little bit more than what you're saying, but it's certainly in that realm. And I mean, just to provide some proportion to that, we spend about $800 billion on defense, you know, everything, you know, having 10 aircraft carriers and, you know, bases around the world, sophisticated weapons cost $800 billion. So we're spending more on interest than on our total defense. Also, we're spending more on interest than on Medicare. You know, you mentioned Medicare, where it's also in that range. It's about $900 billion, and certainly more, it's approaching what we spend on Social Security, which is at about $1.2 trillion, $1.3 trillion. So these are very large numbers. We're talking about interest. And, you know, I mean, you could say we don't get much for it because it crowds out of, you know, actual goods and services that the government needs to provide.
Is this increase in the debt, how much of this can we attribute to the increase in interest rates? Because, of course, as interest rates increase, as you mentioned, that is going to increase our debt because we're paying more on the money that the federal government's borrowed. How much of this increase to our federal debt can be attributed to this increasing interest rates?
Yeah, well, I'll give you a ballpark. I haven't done that calculation, but it's about half. Meaning half of the increase in the interest spending is because of increase in interest rates. That's a ballpark number. So, you know, you mentioned we're spending about $900 billion. About half of that is because of the increase in interest rates. And you know, again, there's a vicious cycle here because one of the big reasons why the Fed had to increase interest rates is because inflation, of course, you know, 2 years ago went through the roof, and the reason why that happened was because, you know, in the first years of the Biden administration, there was just a blowout in spending, and you know, people at the time, you know, people like Larry Summers, who was a Democrat, I said, don't do it. You know, you're gonna increase inflation, which is exactly what happened. So again, these policy mistakes, have a very bad tendency of creating bad consequences down the road, which are very hard to get out of.
And these are bad consequences that will hit home to those depending on things like Medicare or Social Security. I want to talk about Social Security for just a moment. Last year, the federal government distributed $1.4 trillion roughly to Social Security recipients. That's 21% of the federal budget. And again, these are according to the sources that I'm looking at. There's maybe some variance there, but roughly a quarter, 21% of the federal budget went to Social Security. In a recent op-ed, Mark, he said that the trustees of Social Security are not taking into account economic trends, disability benefits, and a declining birth rate. So why aren't they factoring in these important indicators in their projections?
Well, you know, I want to focus on the last, the birth rate, because I think that is the biggest mistake that they're making. And it is a mistake. It's, you know, it's not a matter of an interpretation or, a debate about what the right number is. I think everyone looks at the data. Our birth rate in the United States is about 1.6 children per woman, which, and replacement, you know, just a steady population would require 2.1 actually, children per woman. So we have a declining population in the future. and a declining labor force. And the trustees at Social Security, you know, still have it at 2.0. And so that's a mistake, and it has consequences in terms of the long run. It doesn't matter so much, you know, for the next 10 years. I think, you know, that's pretty much baked in the cake. You might have a little more economic growth, so you might move the exhaustion date for the trust fund 1 year forward, 1 year back. That won't change too much. But in the long run, which of course for Social Security is what we look at, that their projection of a 2.0 birth rate is just way too optimistic, and therefore their assessment of the finances of Social Security is also too optimistic.
Mark, in 1950, there were 16 workers per Social Security beneficiary. In 1960, there were 5 workers per beneficiary. Today, the ratio is roughly 3-1. It's actually 3-1. By 2025, next year, it's going to be just 2.3 workers paying into the Social Security system per beneficiary. Are there structural changes that need to be made to the Social Security system if recipients are going to receive what they're expecting to receive in just 9 years? Again, in 9 years, by 2035, the Social Security is going to be paying out more than what it is receiving, and something is going to have to happen in order to pay out what they are promising recipients at that time.
Well, you know, there are a lot of, clearly, you know, reform of Social Security has to be done on a bipartisan basis, you know, to be sustainable, to be politically sustainable. Those changes which, you know, involve changes in benefits or changes in taxes, you know, have to be done through a political process. But with that being said, there are some smaller changes that can be made, which would be helpful. I mean, they're not going to solve the problem entirely. But one set of smaller changes is basically to encourage more work, to encourage people to work earlier and longer and more. And Social Security has a role to play there. For example, disability is part of Social Security. And I think we can reform the disability program, modernize it, and simplify it, which would encourage work. So that can be done, and that would be helpful to the finances of the program, as well as actually finances of the government as well, because the government collects income taxes on people who work more, and people who don't work and begin to work, you know, their situation improves. Also, we spend less on other welfare benefits. So that's a virtuous cycle. And Social Security has a role to play there. The other aspects, again, these are small changes, but you can make changes in some of the features of Social Security, which, again, would encourage people to work longer. And that's a good solution all around. You know, we were talking before about how people can really protect themselves, you know, from the problems of the federal government in the future. And one way of doing that is to, you know, to rely on yourself in terms of having retirement savings sufficient and to work as long as you can, you know, comfortably. Obviously, if you're not well, or you know, at some point you want to retire, that's of course appropriate and fine. But you know, adding another year of work really is a great way of protecting yourself. And it also is very beneficial to the system.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you. If you're just joining us, you are tuned in to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm your host, Richard Nelson, with Dr. Mark Warshawski of the American Enterprise Institute. Dr. Warshawski, you just mentioned that one way to solve the crisis of Social Security being underfunded and projected to go into the red in 2035 is more people working and people working longer. And yet today, only 16%, I should say, of prime working age men, that's between the ages of 18 to 60, are out of the workforce. 40% of that population, by the way, have college degrees. So for whatever reason, men of working age, and these are not disabled men either, they are capable of working in that they have dropped out of the workforce. Now, in comparison, during the Great Depression, the unemployment rate was about 15%. And that was mostly men, by the way, that were in the workforce. That was viewed as a national crisis back then, a historical inflection point in our nation's history. So why isn't this current trend, and maybe this is another topic or another program, but I'm curious, why aren't we seeing this trend of men dropping out of the workforce being recognized for the crisis that it is? I mean, look, if they were involved in the workforce, this would at least be part of the solution to funding Social Security as it needs to be.
It is, some of my colleagues here at the American Enterprise Institute have looked at that, and I must admit I haven't followed their work closely enough to answer your question, but you're right. I mean, disability is part of it because people do claim disability, if they're not working. They don't always get it, but yet they don't go back to work. So it is something of a mystery. I think some social expectations, general social norms are at play here. Whereas, in past years, people would feel, I would say, almost ashamed not to be working if they could. And that has weakened. But I'm sure there are many other considerations, certainly. Compared to years past, there are a lot of government programs which support people not working. So there's Medicaid, you get your health benefits from Medicaid or from the exchanges, even if you're not working, and other programs. So I think that's part of it. But again, I don't know that that's the full explanation.
I understand that part of what's contributing to this trend is that there is a great transfer of wealth from boomers to Gen Xers and millennials. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $76 trillion is going to be transferred over a 10, 15-year time period or so. And for those that are receiving large inheritance, they're not seeing the need to work. And this is part of what is going on there. Mark, let's look at Medicare. I know you've written on this. You understand the trend here. So as of March 2023, a little over a year ago, almost 66 million Americans were enrolled in Medicare. Last year, about a little over $1 trillion was spent on Medicare. That's a large chunk of our federal budget. So you have an article on financing long-term care is the title of it. And that was in the current issue of National Affairs. And you say that given the nation's aging population and falling birth rate, America's long-term care system is fiscally unsustainable. It's also unfair, riddled with bad incentives, and poorly administered. And matters are getting worse. By putting this back into the intended place, actually, you're referring to Medicaid back into its intended place, and revitalizing private long-term care insurance, we can help ensure that we're offering appropriate assistance to those who need it while putting our public long-term care system on a path to fiscal responsibility. And I think I made the mistake of conflating two different things, Medicare and Medicaid. I didn't look at this, but you're referring in this article to Medicaid, it looks like. But let's go. So both programs, Medicaid and Medicare, are on terrible paths. Let's clarify, first of all, what is the difference between Medicare and Medicaid?
Yeah, sure. There's actually a lot to unpack here. So Medicare is health insurance for the retirees and the disabled. And as you say, it covers about almost 65, 70 million people. It is funded in part by payroll taxes and premiums that people pay, but the vast majority of it is funded by taxes, income taxes, from the directly provided by the government, the federal government. Again, it's a complex program, but that's in a nutshell. Medicaid is also health insurance, and it covers, I don't have the number, it covers also tens of millions of people. It's sort of, you can think about it, it's basically two parts. One is, it is health insurance. It's intended for lower income people, although lower income, particularly after Obamacare, was that level was raised quite a bit, and it was raised again in the Biden administration. So it's almost middle class now in terms of being eligible for Medicaid, and it also covers long term care. The long term care is not health insurance, but it's basically assistance, particularly for the elderly, but it could also be for other disabled people. Who basically need help with the activities of daily living. So it's not health insurance, it's assistance. And in the extreme, it's a nursing home where you really can't do anything for yourself, but it also can be home health aides and other personal assistance. So Medicaid covers that. Now Medicare is a universal program. So if you've paid in, even if you're very wealthy, you're entitled to the benefit. But you do have to work to get the benefit. Medicaid, by contrast, is you don't have to work to get the benefit. It's a welfare program, but ostensibly there are income and asset tests. And where that becomes very relevant is particularly for the elderly, who don't really have necessarily a lot of income, but they may have a lot of assets. And so wealthy people are not supposed to get onto Medicaid. But when I was, in my article, which you quoted, noted how poorly administered it is and the wrong incentives. And point of fact, and it depends state by state, it differs. I don't know about Kentucky. I don't know the details there. But for example, in California, there are no asset limits. You could be literally a billionaire and get onto Medicaid. Whereas in other states, which are much more tightly controlled, I know I'm aware of Idaho and Iowa, for example, they watch out for how much assets you have in order to make sure that wealthy people do not get onto the program. So that's the sense in which it's unfair, and it is poorly administered because you have these vast differences among states, which really the federal government should be overseeing. And it's not sustainable because as the population ages, those more and more people will need those benefits. And Medicaid, and which is paid for both the states and the federal government, simply cannot afford it, as we discussed, a few minutes ago with the increasing deficit. So that's the sense in which it's not sustainable. The other aspect, which, in all the research that I've done is, as healthcare costs, and this is both true for health insurance and for long-term care, are increasing at a faster rate than even general inflation, and that is also a vicious cycle because that increases people's costs. They can't afford what they used to be able to afford, and it increases the government's cost of providing the benefits. And I think we would say that we, despite the rapid increase in cost, we've seen some improvements in quality of care, but not a lot. It seems as if there's a lot of waste and inefficiency in the healthcare system, which if we were able to solve that problem, I think would we get some virtuous cycles going. People their standard of living would improve and the government's costs would go down.
That's good, Mark. Thank you for unpacking that. I know I threw a lot at you there in that question. I'd like to for us to spend the remainder of our time on some positive things that can be done that moves us towards fiscal responsibility. So in an op-ed for National Review earlier in this year, You wrote that the current fiscal direction is unsustainable, but history does provide us with examples and hope that effective and significant fiscal reforms and policy changes, including of social insurance programs, can be negotiated and implemented. If you were to advise the president, whoever the next president will be of the United States, what are some of those reforms and policy changes would you recommend to that person?
Yeah, so let me start with healthcare. So I think one of the big problems in our healthcare system is that it is very inefficient. It does not have much productivity increase compared to the rest of the economy, where you see big productivity increases with, you know, through artificial intelligence, AI, the application of technology and electronic methods, communication methods, which reduce costs. So, like, you know, I mean, I just mentioned Amazon. I mean, Amazon reduced costs because of their innovations, but we don't see that in healthcare. And I think that's what we need to see, and that's what I would advise the president. That, for example, the National Institute of Health has a budget of, I don't know, it's like something like $50, $60 billion. And, you know, it does good work and it encourages research and innovations. But I think a big part of that needs to be reallocated and basically encourage the healthcare system to apply technology to reduce costs, not to increase costs, which is what happens right now. And so, for example, you know, the application of AI, you know, could reduce costs in healthcare. The research has shown this, but it's not being applied right now because the incentives aren't there. So I would very much encourage the president to, you know, change the direction and really focus on something that, you know, would be a win-win, you know, because reducing costs in healthcare and having better care, you know, through the application of more efficient technologies would be a win-win, and that's something that the government can help with. In fact, only the government can do this because the incentives in healthcare right now are so mixed up.
Very good. Dr. Mark Warshawski of the American Enterprise Institute, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. We appreciate your wisdom and insights here, and thank all of you for joining us here. If you've enjoyed the program, please tell your friends about us and then go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us. We would greatly appreciate it. Until next time, may God bless you, and we'll see you then.